Hey everyone, this is Ismay, musician, host, and creator of Finding Lucinda. In anticipation of our documentary film coming out this fall, I've put together an in-depth companion podcast. It delves into the origins and artistry of legendary singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. New episodes are out every other week on the BGS Podcast Network. So join me on this creative journey. I drove away from Houston, still thinking about John Grimaldo, Lucinda's first guitarist. He had made the choice to step away from the dream of being a full-time musician. Instead, he chose to spend time with his family, go fishing, play music less, and make a living painting houses. At the time I was driving east, away from Texas, I did not think that that would be my fate. I had no judgment of John's choices. I understood them intellectually. But I felt that I was heading in the opposite direction. I was just getting started. I thought that just maybe this could be the time to put myself fully out there. I could break out of the straitjacket that bound me, stop self-sabotaging. As John said to do, I go for it. As I drove, I was not asking myself, should I do this? I wasn't thinking about potential unintended consequences of a choice like this. At the time, I was only thinking, could I do this? Was I even good enough? Was I making a fool of myself by putting my music out there more fully? I was heading from Houston towards the east. My destination, the studio where Lucinda made her very first record, Ramblin' on My Mind, Jackson, Mississippi. This was the very first place Lucinda stepped into a recording booth, the first time she made her way up to stand in front of those fancy microphones. The first place where tiny particles of iron oxide on reel-to-reel tape fell into place, according to her singing, her playing. I wondered what it was like for her, recording for the very first time like that. I wondered if maybe she asked herself similar questions to what I was asking myself. Perhaps when she slid those metal finger picks onto her right hand, cracked her back and pulled the guitar strap over her head, she asked this inside her own mind. Am I good enough to do this? Will anyone even listen to this? In Jackson, I was going to go to Malico Studios. I wanted to ask what Lucinda was like during that tectonic experience of recording for the first time. But I was also headed there to sort of test myself, to find out if I go to that same place, if I stand in front of a microphone with my acoustic guitar, would I be proven to have something to offer? Would I come across as worthy of something? I wondered about the engineer. It would be the same guy who had been there with Lucinda 40 years ago. I wondered what he would say to his friends and colleagues after I left. Would he say, "Wow, that wasn't so great. What a waste of a day." Or would he say something like, "Wow, that person has a lot of good music to offer. I wonder why they're doubting themselves so much." You are listening to Finding Lucinda from The Bluegrass Situation. I'm your host, Ismay. This podcast is an audio documentary, a multi-part series. It recounts my journey to trace the origins of my musical hero, Lucinda Williams. in order to confront my sense of self-doubt and find a path forward with my aspirations to be a singer-songwriter, I decided to do a road trip. And on that trip, my guiding light was Lucinda. You are listening to Episode 6, Lucinda's First Recording Session. I was driving my 95 Ford truck to Mississippi. I skipped around New Orleans, skirted just past Opelousas. It was May, 2022. The trees along the roadside were a heightened shade of green. They bursted in growth. Little leaves swelled up in anticipation of a summer's worth of sunshine and rain. I admired the green blur through my window for a few hours, and then I pulled over to a patch of gravel along the roadside. There I saw a large pond and a ditch along the side. So I walked. The body of water was over an acre in size. This was all agricultural land. Similar ponds just like it went on for miles and miles and miles all around. Tiny spears of green grass broke through the surface of the water. I thought maybe in these ponds they were growing rice. Or perhaps, deep down, munching in the mud, were crawfish, waiting to be plucked up any day now, waiting for their god to determine some trajectory in this world. A big red sun was sinking down on the horizon. I sat down, took out my notebook. I picked a little plant. I began to draw the leaves. The edges were irregular. Bugs had nibbled them down.
You can hear some electricity, which is not so fun, but you can also hear bugs, wind, and cars. And a buzzing fly. And if you start to just notice the swallows are swallowing water, they go across and dip in. It's kind of interesting being here, like, near Lake Charles, because you can just kind of think about Lucinda's songwriting about. This is the kind of place she was in when she was writing a lot of her songs, where she came from. It's interesting how human beings pick things and then we put so much importance on them, even if they may not be more important. Now this plant matters a lot more to me than all the other exact same kind of species plants in this whole field. Think about that when I find, you know, there's all these records of people performing and we're just looking for the Lucinda records. There might have been somebody who saved a bunch of videos or saved a bunch of recordings and didn't really think they were all that important, but they saved them anyways. And then we come along and say, this is the most important thing in the universe. We need this. And then we find the recording that was saved without regard or knowledge, without knowledge of its importance. And then we place importance on it. And so is creation. And just because I drew the silly little drawing, this single plant, all of a sudden it gets important and is memorialized for longer. Just like when you record a certain artist, that's blues artist or the other, memorialized forever and then they become important. Just like Lucinda recorded her, memorialized forever, and she became important. Repeated, replicated. Now you can replicate this drawing with a photocopy machine. Importance, being important is an odd thing in this world.
I spent that night at a chain hotel, three stories high, dozens of rooms, gleaming, but middling in quality. This building was probably just a handful of years old. It's the kind of place where you roll in late and you feel like you could be anywhere, America. The New Jersey Turnpike, Madison, Wisconsin, the border of Florida and God knows where. I carted my guitar in on a metal gurney. The automatic glass door welcomed me with ice-cold, dry air. A friendly brown-haired lady behind the desk handed me a branded plastic hotel key. I made my way through the quiet, anonymous hallways without encountering another person. As usual, as soon as I got to my room, I grabbed the guaranteed sanitized channel changer. I laid on the luxuriously white and unwrinkled sheets. Then I turned on my favorite TV show, Law & Order SVU, and fell right asleep. In the morning, I found dense bagels and brown paper bags to put them in. A yellowish-looking orange fruit for accompaniment. I dropped 6 tiny creamers into my watery coffee. I may sound like I'm describing something drab and even depressing. The conformity, the dryness of a place like this could bring somebody down. But these kind of places made me comfortable. They were predictable. The clean white rooms, the morning hunt for a decent cup of coffee I could swallow down. And I liked the kids shouting in the hotel pool midday. And I think this meant that I was suited for motel life. And maybe that meant that I could be a touring musician. Of course, I missed the ranch and the horses, but not enough to make my soul ache. I was cuddled in the neutrality of this hotel, ready for the next adventure to begin. It was almost like places like these, motels that are generic. They provided a blank chalkboard for me to scribble out my life's creations. I had another full day of driving to get to Jackson, but that gave me another chance to discover the landscape of Lucinda's childhood. Cotton fields stretching miles and miles, broken down shacks and engine parts. A few hours in, I made a stop at a gas station where 5 chickens danced around on the pavement. They darted from car to car, waiting for people to drop their tortilla chips out of the corners of their mouths, for kids to leave plastic bags with dusty remnants of Cheetos on the ground. It was the perfect place for some half-wild poultry. In the afternoon, I veered off the highway to a small town, Centerville, Mississippi, population 1,600. The small main street had a vintage feel, an old general store with plain white shelves, and a Coca-Cola machine outside. I pulled up to a spot by the town park. This park was about the size of a half block. There were dozens of people gathered there, which seemed unusual, and music was playing. And I realized that this was not just an average Sunday in Centerville. It was the town's annual crawfish festival. Little boiling pots of these steamy red shrimpy morsels, corn cobs amongst the shells. I walked around the edge, too shy to interact with anybody. A group of 13-year-old kids buzzed across the street and around me. They were on motorbikes and four-wheelers. Some were paired up on the pleather seats on a single vehicle. Wild and happy kids. I felt right at home. I thought of Lucinda. If she had been there observing a day like this in a town like this, I wondered what lyrics she would use to describe the scenes she saw. A couple more hours on the road, and I rolled into Jackson. It was quiet. I got to stay in a historic hotel, my favorite. I found one place to get a late-night meal, a steak and a potato delivered right to my door. I fell asleep as the TV was blabbering on, ready to meet the next morning, satisfied in a way only a day driving like that could make me feel satisfied. In the morning, I took a turn around town before going to the studio. The city was lovely, vintage architecture, old signs for laundromats that hadn't been modified since the 60s, new housing developments with a Scandinavian feel, tall white metal siding. I had never been to Jackson. However, its lore was ever present in my knowledge of country music. After all, one of the most iconic country songs was about this place. I'm going to Jackson, gonna mess around. Johnny Cash and June Carter sang it. So did Nancy Sinatra and Lee Hazlewood. And of course, a big genre in this city and region had been the blues. But Jackson also had a distinguished role in a more recently developed genre, R&B and soul. And many of the significant recordings to emerge in these genres came from Jackson, and specifically Malico Studios, the place where I was going to be interviewing this guy, Wolf Stevenson. Wolf had worked on many of the iconic R&B and soul recordings, and he was the engineer for Lucinda's first record. We sat down together in the break room at Malico. Each of us took one booth. They were that kind that's a replication from old diner seats. On the kitchen counter, in an Instapot, he was cooking red beans and rice. Little slices of hot doggy sausage bubbled around as we spoke.
Here we are.
Here we are. Are these booths new? A new addition or?
No, they're new when we rebuilt the studio.
Got it. Okay.
When we owned Muscle Shoals Sound Studio.
Malico Studios got its start in 1967, largely in part to this guy I was sitting down with, Wolf Stevenson, and also in part to another guy, Tommy Couch. Wolf and Tommy had been fraternity brothers in college. They had both booked bands while they were there. And eventually, they ended up putting out records. They developed Malico Studios as a place other people could come and record. Tommy and Wolf collaborated with huge record labels, Capitol, Mercury, Stax. Mostly Malico was known for Southern soul, blues, R&B, and gospel music. A couple years after opening, Wolf and Tommy had a huge break. A hit song. But interestingly, Wolf told me that this song barely squeaked out into the world. The journey to find an audience was circuitous. There was this guy, King Floyd. He had started out as a street performer in New Orleans. He then joined the army, and then went up to New York City and over to the West Coast. And in 1970, King Floyd went to Malico Studios to record vocals for a new record. There was a producer who had a production deal with Malico at the time, and he was the one producing the track, Wardell Quazerg. After they were done, Wolf and Tommy thought that this recording was fantastic. So you, in the audience, you might know this song. I certainly listened to it a lot while I was growing up. It is called Groove Me. Here's a little line. Hey there, sugar dumpling, let me tell you something. Wolf and Tommy were so excited about the prospects of the album that King Floyd had made with this producer. So much so that Tommy traveled all the way to New York City to play it for record companies. He brought it to Stax. He brought it to Atlantic. He brought it to 8 more record companies. And they all said no. But Wolf and Tommy, they didn't give up. They decided, fine, we'll just press it down here ourselves, put it out on our own label. And they hand-delivered this record to a DJ nearby to get some airplay. It was Friday when they brought the album to the DJ, and he was just about done for the day. But he said, "I'll bring it home and give it a whirl." And it just so happened that this DJ's niece was having a sleepover that weekend with some friends and family at his house. When the DJ put the record on, starting with the B-side, all the little girls perked up. They loved the song Groove Me. They danced, and they played it over and over and over again. When Monday came, the DJ went back to Wolf and Tommy and said, "You have a smash hit here." The DJ played it on the radio, and it grew to become a huge crossover hit song. Anyways, that's how Melico first made its name, as a label and a studio. They followed up this success with another hit from the same producer, Wardell Quisarg. This time it was sung by Gene Knight. The song was Mr. Big Stuff. Melico attracted big clients for recording, like Paul Simon. But when Lucinda went to record at Melico Studios in the late 70s, it wasn't really because of this history of soul hits. After all, that wasn't really what she was chasing. It was because she had a family connection. Lucinda's father, Miller, had a friend who was a patron of the arts, Tom Royals. He was a civil rights attorney. He lived in Jackson and had supposedly gotten a guy off a drug charge who worked at Melico Studios. So this guy owed Tom Royals a favor. And Tom used that favor to bring Lucinda in for a day of recording. Tom Royals had pretty much no experience in the music industry, but he became the quote-unquote producer of Lucinda's first album. Years later, people would occasionally come up to Tom and say, "Are you the guy that produced Lucinda Williams' first album?" and ask for his signature. Before Tom Royals passed away in 2019, the newspaper, the Jackson Clarion Ledger, interviewed him about Lucinda Williams. They asked about his experience making Ramblin' on My Mind with her, and he spoke about what it was like that day. And he also talked about how he used to go see Lucinda play around when she was getting started. And he had something interesting to say about Lucinda's vision for her success as an artist at the time. He said, quote, "All of those grueling hours she spent playing the Holiday Inn with cigarette smoke filling her lungs, working day in and day out, and it never occurred to her that she wasn't going to make it." Tom Royals had passed away, but I did have this chance to speak with the other person who was there in 1978. So Wolf was the engineer on Ramblin' on My Mind. And I decided that that day at Melico, in addition to interviewing Wolf, I would do something else. I would record a song myself. It would be just like Lucinda from back in the day. I had to see if I was up to the task. I'd prepared some songs that Lucinda recorded back then in 78. Satisfied Mind, The Great Speckled Bird. I wasn't totally sure if these songs were suited to me, but I thought I'd give them a shot. There had been 40 years between Lucinda's session and mine. The comparison was arising within my psyche, whether I wanted to admit it or not.
And then, boom, she took off after that.
So tell me about that day that she came to record here.
It was fun. It really was a fun session. It was just as laid back as you could expect. You know, no stop, let's punch in, no, none of that. Just go through the song, kick it off, and in the middle, if she didn't like it, stop. Oh, let's go start over. and do the whole thing. I was very pleased that she got a deal. And it was totally different than the kind of music we were doing at the time. And we wouldn't have been able to do as much with it as she had done here.
So what do you remember about her that afternoon when you were recording? What was she like back then?
She was as down to earth as she could possibly be. No put on airs or anything, just as friendly, just like, hey, how you doing? And we're having a big time. Of course, it helped that she and Tom were knew each other quite well. And we just all fell in and had a great time in the studio. It was not really a very structured session. She said, I've got these songs, and get through one, okay, what's next? But it was fun working with her, really was.
And was she really confident in her music back then? Was she kind of, it was her first recording session, so she was probably figuring it out.
Maybe the technique, but as far as what she wanted to do, if she got something a little off, she was confident that, okay, we need to stop and do this again. Yeah, she was comfortable. She wasn't spooked at all in the session. She was really laid back. And John was great as an accompanying guy.
So she knew what she wanted.
Absolutely. Mm. And she'd ask for, okay, does that sound right? How's the balance? And of course, would throw in my 2 cents there.
Yeah, I'm just curious too about like the particular selection of songs that she had. What was it about, certain artists like Memphis Minnie or Robert Johns? What was it about the songwriting and the music, emotionally?
Well, it's songs that I had heard before many times, but she put her own little signature on it. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that she used those songs, because they are pretty powerful tunes. And you've got to be brave to come up with those songs and present that. So you got to know that you can deliver it well and put your own little twist on it. But they were very well-known songs, and that in itself will hold somebody's attention for a few seconds, and then they listen and say, well, she's singing pretty good, so she's playing all right. Yeah, let's listen to a little bit more.
So you're saying she was pretty bold to do these songs
yeah,
that were popular already. Well, there were already so many people that had covered them, too.
Sure, there sure was. And for her to get a deal with a label using those songs is somewhat unique. It was back then, anyway.
So you're saying she wasn't confident in her own songwriting.
I'm not sure if that was what it was or not. I didn't know what her original tunes were like at the time, because I'd seen her around town a couple of times, but not a whole lot. She may have had some great songs back in her little notebook, but I did not know what else she was going to do. But if I had to guess, I would say that she wanted to use this as get the door open and then start introducing some of her own material.
And she probably wanted also just to get a chance to really learn from these songs too.
Yeah, sure. Because if you present cover songs, you better grit your teeth and do it right. Because you're always going to be compared with the song as the original tunes. And obviously she did a good job of that because she got their attention right away.
So she had a sound in her voice and her playing and her style.
She did. And to me, it sounded just like she sounded as she was sitting and talking to you. She was very loose and comfortable in her presentation. And her playing was really good. So she carried it out, carried it right to the house.
Yeah, I like that in an artist when you can hear their speaking voice and their singing voice are connected.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like she's singing all the time.
She was authentic.
Absolutely. I mean, day-to-day life, she was just as footloose and very natural.
So her playing and her singing was just an extension of herself.
I would say that for sure.
Do you think that's true of a lot of artists, or do you find some artists it's like their performing and musical self is a different persona?
The really good ones, you can see it in their offstage persona as well as onstage. That's what I think. I mean, there are some artists that, if you're lucky enough, I have been lucky to meet a lot of them, and after listening to their tunes, I said, wow, that he sounds like the guy I've seen on stage, or a guy I've listened to, or the girl I've listened to on the radio, or listening to their records.
And so you said you saw Lucinda play in a couple venues before she ever came here to record. Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything about that?
Very little. There's several places that are no longer in existence, and that was back in the early, mid to late 70s. There was so much going on back then, I don't remember where it was. There are two or three places it could have been, but they're long gone.
And do you remember what your impression was of her when you saw her play?
It was a good impression. I mean, I was, wherever the club was, I remember her playing, and I said, wow, she's pretty good. But it was something different than what we were doing. So I listened to it and thought it was great. But as far as her doing something that we could take and develop, I knew it was not our thrust, our main bag of stuff that we did. Because we were really concentrating on soul and blues and soul gospel.
So you felt like she had a trajectory, but it was just going to be somewhere else, in sort of a different genre.
And when she got on Folkways, I said, well, this is a good avenue for her, because the way she came across in the studio. Now, she's gone a little different since then.
So what do you remember about John Grimaldo from that recording?
To be truthful, not a lot, except that he was an excellent player. I mean, he was here to do the backup on her, but I mean, he was Johnny on the spot as far as let's try it this way or let's try that. I mean, he was exceptionally good.
It's interesting because we talked to him in Houston. We did an interview, and it was interesting to talk to him and kind of compare him to Lucinda, because, you know, Lucinda and him recorded this together, and she went on to keep getting, you know, more and more successful as an artist. And he moved to a small town in Texas and kept playing music, but he never kind of went beyond that.
Yeah, that's happened with a lot of folks that have come through here. And a lot of them that I thought were fantastic. There's one guy that we started out early with, that fantastic writer and acoustic guitar player and singer, and a great writer of songs that would just make you stop and listen. And I think had he showed up 10 years later than that, we might have been able to do something with him.
So part of an artist being able to kind of maybe get to the point they want in their career, get to a higher point, somewhat about timing.
Absolutely. Timing and a little bit of luck, and it's just amazing when the right person happens to come by and hear it.
So it sounds kind of like, even, I'm sure a lot of people came to you guys wanting your help with getting their music out there, but even that, you guys didn't even have complete power. Everybody was kind of relying on someone else.
Yeah, it was always that. I mean, Jerry Wexler at Atlantic Records, the first stuff we carried to him, first big hits we had, they turned them all down. So what did we do? We came back down here, scratched our head, and said, well, let's just put one out ourselves. In the end, even back then, we had to do something ourselves to get it started.
Yeah, I mean, I totally get that with trying to get the help of somebody who might be kind of a level up from you, and they say no, and you just kind of have to do it yourself because you believe in it.
And a lot of people just go back home after that. You know, they just say, well, they don't like it. It must not be any good. But we kept listening. We said, well, let's give it a shot.
That's interesting. So some people put their heart and soul into their music, and then somebody tells them it's not good enough.
That's
and
right.
They listen to that, and then they just give up.
They do, and that's really sad. I've heard some folks that over the years that I really thought were exceptional, and they wind up playing in local venues for years and years and years and never go any further.
Interesting. It's the maybe it's the sting of the rejection. They just can't handle doing it again.
That could be it, and are just not having enough gumption to or drive to keep going. For sometimes it might take them years, and they just didn't have the drive to do that. Or they come back and say, "Well, okay, I'll do something else," you know, not really worry about it.
Maybe that's what made Lucinda different, is she was kind of dogged about her music.
Absolutely. And I think she had an idea that, okay, I may have to work at this for several years, but I'm going to give it a shot. I'm sure she was getting good reception at the venue she played. And where she came up with the idea of taking all cover tunes and doing that, that's pretty brave, but it worked. Mm-hmm. And then because it was her version of those songs, the songs were very well known, and at least somebody would listen to them for a few seconds because of the song. And then after they listen a few seconds, they hear, well, okay, she's singing this pretty good. Well, she's playing pretty good. So, and capture them for a few more seconds, and then she got them.
Right. So do you think if this Folkways hadn't put out this record, do you think she would have given up?
No, I don't think so. I think she's exhibited enough drive when she was here doing the session that had they passed, she would have done another one and kept going.
So she had that. It's not that she was necessarily, you know, there's lots of talented people out there who have amazing music, but the fact that she just kept going for it and didn't give up and didn't listen to other people telling her she wasn't good enough.
That for sure. I don't know if anybody ever told her she wasn't good enough, but they just wouldn't get too excited about it, maybe. Mm. But she had that little something in her voice that was a little twang up in there somewhere that stuck out.
Yeah, I know. I've been talking to some other people about her, and they said that she stood out for sure amongst her peers when she was playing in the 70s.
Yeah, she did. And then from delivering those songs to writing her own and delivering those with powerful songs and her delivery, that cemented the deal right there. I mean, you can go so far on somebody else's tunes, but eventually you're going to put some of your own self in there.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because she had this powerful voice and played really well, and she was confident. But also, her first big success was Passionate Kisses being played by somebody else.
You talk about a big success, too. Boom. I heard that, and I said, oh, my goodness. I said, you're home now, baby. I'd heard her play the song, but man, that was it was pretty much the way she did it too. I mean, it's pretty true to the way she was thinking that the song should go. It didn't change much.
So I know that too. I know she struggled a little bit after she started writing her own songs and releasing her own material. She was turned down by a lot of record labels because she wasn't country and she wasn't rock.
Yeah.
Did you hear that in her music too? Sort of that it was in between genres?
Or? Yeah, it was its own fastball coming through there. And they just missed it. And maybe they were trying to limit it to one or the other. But I'm sure a lot of folks passed up because she was a little bit to the left of where they were headed.
And she could have just decided in that time to just, okay, I'll be more rock, or okay, I'll be more country, but she didn't.
I don't think she ever would have done that. I mean, she came across as so original in the stuff she did. And even these songs, with her singing them, I mean, she was putting her whole heart in it when she was doing that. And obviously the Folkways heard that. And I don't know if they knew she was capable of writing some more original material, but she later did. But she did well for a number of years before she really hit it big with her writing even.
It seems like she took her a long time to get really successful.
And it happens a lot with people that are hard to put in this little category or that little category. The fans love her, but what kind of music is it? Well, I'm not sure, you know.
Well, do you think that artists like that, that don't necessarily play to kind of the expectations, are more impactful than somebody who might just kind of be doing what people kind of have already heard?
Yeah, you got to come up with something to jump to that next level. And her writing, along with her performances, cemented it for her. The writing is a big part of it. Eventually, you got to concentrate some on that.
Right.
Or have a great writer that you're working with, one of the two.
Yeah, I definitely struggle a little bit.
Partway through the interview, Wolf pulled something out to share with me. Some old items from his archives. Two things. First, a vinyl copy of Ramblin' on My Mind, an original. The cover showed an old photo of wooden and tin shacks. Behind them was an eroded hillside. The photograph was of the outskirts of Tupelo, Mississippi. A photograph by Walker Evans, who was known for documenting the effects of the Great Depression. It's somber for a cover, but evocative of the people and cultures that produced the music that Lucinda was playing. Then Wolf showed me something very, very special. It was a crisp piece of white paper, blue ink with clear handwriting. It was seemingly untouched for 40 years. It was a letter Lucinda had written to Wolf back after Ramblin' on My Mind had just come out.
And then we'll go on with a couple more questions. This is so cool. Okay, so Lucinda wrote this to you after Ramblin' came out, and she says, "Dear Wolf, sorry it took me so damn long getting this to you. I hope you at least got to see Tom's copy. I'm in some place I can't pronounce presently, performing and trying to get a new demo together with a band." So she was working on another record. "I have several good new originals." Okay.
Great.
Wow. Okay. "Spent 8 months in New York City, and that was a trip. I met Bob Dylan, and he heard my stuff and liked it. I gave him a copy of the album, but I really need to send him a demo of my own songs. Also, Nem4 Records in New York has expressed an interest in me, and I also spoke with and played for John Hammond. I hope to be in Jackson in the near future if I can get some gigs lined up. I have a VW camper van and a PA system now, so I'm prepared. Hope things are going fine for you. Take care. Lucinda."
That's great. The VW camper van fits right in there.
I love that. She was traveling around with her camper van with a PA system just trying to play in front of people.
But she was thinking about those original songs all the time.
Yeah, this shows one of the early points in time where she was going from Ramblin' with the covers to starting to think about her own songs. And she gave them to Bob Dylan, who was her favorite artist.
I can see that he would have been.
And that must have been a lot of confidence she had to give it to him.
Sure.
That's a big
deal.
Well,
he would recognize it. It's something about her, just like yourself. I mean, you've been doing this a while, and you've got goals that you want to do. Mm-hmm. And people pay attention. Mm. If they don't pay attention, you're not being serious about it.
Yeah, that's something I've struggled with a little bit, is this unintentional not being super competent is kind of, I realized, kind of something I had an issue with, because I was asking people about a year ago, you know, how do I come across? And I try really hard to come across as not egotistical, and I want it to be about the music. I want someone to hear the music and that to be the reason they care. I don't want them to care because I talk a big game.
Right.
But on the other hand, being confident in the music also makes people perk up and give a listen.
They do, and they get an impression of you as somebody that's really dedicated to the music that you do. Mm. And believe me, it comes across when you're performing and singing.
Yeah, I believe it, and I think I hadn't realized, but when I was talking to people about kind of how they perceived what I was doing, They told me, like, oh, they didn't know what I wanted. And I wanted to be a professional musician. I wanted to be someone who makes records and gets to play in front of people. And I hadn't realized that me being a little more withdrawn and not and trying not to be egotistical, people thought that meant I didn't care.
Yeah.
And that wasn't it at all.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of working on that side of things because I do care a lot. It's what I, you know, want to do with my life. And I still keep it about the music, but it's just interesting to hear you talk about her and read this letter and hear about how confident she was in what she was doing.
She was, and you've come across as being confident about your own. You can get there. All right, we're going to uncover these Louisiana red beans and stir them just a bit.
Check.
We got out of the booth seats and each got a plate of Louisiana red beans and rice. We mixed it together on the paper plates with our plastic forks. It tasted great. As I sat, I thought about what Wolf had said about that day of recording with Lucinda. I realized that at least outwardly, Lucinda was really confident. She was certain this was what she wanted to do. This was a step she wanted to take to move forward. And honestly, it was impressive hearing that the first time Lucinda ever went into a studio, she didn't get tripped up at all. She had to make a whole record in basically one day. But probably all those years playing at places like Anderson Fair and on the street in New Orleans had really made her capable of doing this. But even though she seemed certain on the outside, perhaps there were doubts, thoughts that she didn't want to share with other people. She might have wanted to appear cool and calm. She might have wanted to make it seem like it came easy to her. But ultimately, that's all speculation on my part. Perhaps she was certain and confident. What is also so fascinating about the story of Lucinda at Malico is that the way that it all went was not inevitable. There were so many off-ramps Lucinda could have taken. She could have never tried to get a record deal, never reached out to Mo Ash. She could have bailed and never actually went to do the recording. She could have said, "Man, these songs stink," and never shared them with Folkways. Many other artists have let small roadblocks stop them, but not Lucinda. She was dogged about what she wanted to do, and by God, it worked. After eating red beans and rice, I was getting ready to step into the recording booth. I would act as a sort of shadow, replicating the steps Lucinda took in the late 70s. But first, Wolf wanted to show me something. He wanted to take me into the tape vault. It was the only surviving building after the tornado that tore through Jackson a few years earlier. And Wolf said something that completely amazed and surprised me. He said he had found something. Something that he had no memory of even having been there. A set of reel-to-reel tapes from the late 70s that did not correspond to Lucinda's first album. Something that most likely no one had heard since they were made.
Well, look here. Who do we see?
Ooh, we got Lucinda.
There we go.
So this is from the original 1978 recordings?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. There's stuff in there that's not on the...
There is. And guess what? Two or three of them are originals.
Wow, really?
Yep.
So well, unheard.
We'll go give them a listen.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to episode 7 of Finding Lucinda. Our next episode is number 8. We'll be uncovering old tapes from the archives. One thing I wanted to share with you that is exciting. We're doing a Finding Lucinda tour. We're going to be doing live music playing Lucinda Williams songs, as well as a screening of the documentary film that's based on the same story as this podcast. So far, we've announced a date in Chico, California. We'll be adding dates in San Francisco and across the whole country. If you want to attend, it'll be the fall of 2025. You can find all those dates at findinglucinda.com. Thanks for listening, and see you round the bend.